21CL Radio.
Happy Wednesday morning to you, and welcome to the Education Vanguard. I'm your host, Michael Bull, and I'm thrilled to have you here. Thank you so much. And I also want to give a big thank you out there to our listening audience. Your support helps us. It helps us to find and recognize educational leaders out there. Today, I've got a great show for your wallet. I'm going to talk to Andrew Hallam, better known as the Millionaire Teacher. Not everybody gets life-changing investment advice while working a summer job pumping gas in Canada, but my guest today had just that happen to him. Serendipity was smiling on Andrew Hallam when he chatted up the garage mechanic about life and money. Turns out he was a millionaire thanks to some responsible investing and its consistent returns. This, of course, got Andrew thinking and interested in the world of investing. While not the millionaire mechanic, Andrew instead became the millionaire teacher. Not content to just revel in the freedom, Andrew went on to share his knowledge via a regular column, two books, including The Millionaire Teacher and The Global Expatriate's Guide to Investing, and of course, this very podcast. This is an extended interview, and it covers the basics of investing for international teachers. It is a must listen. Enjoy the conversation. Andrew, thanks so much for joining me on the program today.
Thanks for the invite.
Well, great to have you here. Now, I heard about you from a buddy of mine who went to an IRCOS conference probably like 5 years ago, and he said, you got to check out The Millionaire Teacher. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to kind of wait and see if 5 years from now he becomes the former millionaire teacher. But that didn't happen. You're still doing okay in the investment world, huh?
Yeah.
So no problems there. Well, that's good to know. So I wanted to, there's so much we can cover here. So we've got sort of an outline that we talked about a little bit before the show. But we thought we'd start right away with getting into what your investment philosophy is. Now, when you look at your email address, it contains the words invest like Buffet. So do you say that you should just invest in a wide variety of things? Is that what you mean by that email address?
Actually, that email address is a invest like Buffett. So that's Warren Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha from Omaha, Nebraska. And what Warren Buffett has done for his wife is in his will, essentially, he's laid out a financial plan for his wife. He's quite a few years older than she is. Mm-hmm. And he says that when I kick it, he said he wants all of his wife's money to be invested in two index funds, a United States stock market index fund and a United States bond market index fund. And that's it. And Warren Buffett's a guy who knows any manager or money professional who's worth their weight in salt. Warren Buffett knows who they are. So if you think about it, it's quite interesting in that he could have chosen anybody to invest his wife's money once he passes on. Mm-hmm. But he recognizes that the highest statistical odds of investment success are to keep costs as low as possible. And that's why he advocates products called index funds. So the invest like Buffett email is not one that I really use all that often. So that's not my private email. I used to, years ago, have a portfolio that was comprised of individual stocks and index funds. Now, Warren Buffett, I would purchase my individual stocks using Warren Buffett's tenets. So looking for strong businesses with low debt, high return on total capital, businesses that are simple, that I could understand, businesses that any idiot could run, because one day an idiot will be running it. So this is sort of Warren Buffett's mantra. And what he does recommend, however, for normal investors, regular investors, is that, you know what, individual stock picking isn't really what he recommends to most people. Invest with index funds instead, which is what he's done with his wife's money. He doesn't even trust anybody in the world to invest his wife's money and give them decent odds of beating a portfolio of indexes. So what I've done and what I've done in the books that I've written is to promote a complete portfolio of index funds and no individual stocks at all.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit then more specifically about that investment philosophy. So obviously, you know, you chose that email address probably quite a while ago, so you've stuck with that philosophy. And a big part of it that we've talked about before the show is low fees. So can you tell me a little bit about your philosophy and how it relates to having extremely or as low fees as you possibly can when it comes to investing?
Well, whatever you pay in fees, you don't get in investment returns. And I'm going to give you an example of something.
Okay.
The average expatriate probably pays about 3.5% per year in fees. And most of those fees are hidden. And it doesn't sound like a lot.
No, it doesn't.
But if the investment before fees makes a 7% return and the investor is paying 3.5% in fees, then they are giving up half of the profits. So literally 50% of what would be their profit goes to the financial service industry.
So it isn't they're not taking a percentage on the overall portfolio, or are they taking on just the profit or loss you make for the year?
That's a great question. They take a percentage of the total portfolio every single year. Win or lose.
Okay.
And so if that portfolio before fees increased by 7%, you deduct the 3.5% fee, it'll only increase by 3.5%. So what they've taken is they've taken 50% of the profits for that year. Now, when you compound that out over time, you get these extraordinary differences between, let's say, a portfolio that charges 0.5% in fees versus a 3% in fees. The person paying 3% in fees essentially has to save 3 to 4 times as much money every month just to keep up with the wealth of somebody who's paying a quarter of what they're paying in fees.
Okay, so to sum up your philosophy in a sense, it's invest in something like an index type fund where you're not relying on any individual specifically. You're doing a broad market and chase as low a fees or go for as low as fees as you can. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. So understanding that the lower the fees, the better, number one. Two is to build a diversified portfolio that gives you global exposure. So you don't just have exposure to a single market like the British market, say you're British. You would want exposure to the British stock market and the global stock market as a whole. And then you'd want, for stability, a bond component. So bonds, they're not very sexy. They don't increase or decrease like stocks do, but they stabilize the portfolio. And the idea being that obviously there are years when the markets rise and there are years when the markets fall. The best thing to do is to rebalance that portfolio every year. So if the markets have risen, and let's assume you have a portfolio that has 30% British stocks, you're British, let's say, so 30% British stock index, 30% global stock index, and 40% bond index, for example. If stocks rise in a given year, all of a sudden your portfolio is going to be out of whack. You're going to have a lot more in stocks than bonds.
Yeah, and so, you're usually busy celebrating at that point.
And so, yeah, but at that point, the best thing to do is at the end of the year, you just pick a calendar date, just pick a point in time. It could be your birthday, Elvis's birthday, January 1st. It really doesn't matter. You rebalance back to the original allocation. And what's hard about that, Mike, is what you're going to be doing is you're going to be selling off little pieces of the winners,
right,
and you're going to be buying a little bit of what you may think are the losers. So the best thing, obviously, we have is understanding costs, building a diversified portfolio, rebalancing it, and never speculating. And that's really important. Never think or let anyone convince you that a certain stock market is going to do well. Well, put your money in China right now because China is set to go, or put your money in the US, or hey, avoid the US right now because it's at a high. The idea is don't speculate, don't listen to the people that speculate, rebalance a portfolio. And we have reams of academic evidence suggesting that all of the people that do the forecasting, they may sound really smart on CNBC and the likes, but their odds of being right when they forecast are less than the odds of you flipping a coin.
So they're right less than half the time.
Correct.
Well, so you should listen to them and do the opposite, because then you're getting a 60% chance of being successful rather than 50-50, right?
there are some people who have done that, but I don't recommend it.
I guess you don't know who's the 40% and who's the 60%.
That's right.
All right, let me ask you this then. So you got the advisors that are charging their high fees. You got yourself that you could do it on your own, so it's much less expensive. What about some of these nifty websites that have come up, like Wealthfront or Betterment, groups like that, that charge a little bit more than what you charge on your own, but will do that rebalancing for you and do some of that work for you? What do you think of those as a middle option?
Brilliant. They are brilliant if the fees are low enough. And so okay. The two firms that you mentioned, the fees are low enough. There's a firm that I write for called Asset Builder, mm-hmm. Very much like Betterment. They're based in Texas, and they accept expatriate American clients only, but they charge about 0.5 or 0.45% to rebalance a portfolio. So they build the diversified portfolio of index funds. They charge about 0.45% per year mm-hmm. to have that portfolio rebalanced each year. So they manage it for the investor. And those are wonderful because they take out the speculative component. They take out the fear and the greed that many people end up falling victim to. They end up getting really excited when something rises in value, and they think that's good, so they like to buy a lot of it, or they'll hear that something is destined to drop, and so they'll foolishly sell that. And because of that, I'll give you a really interesting statistic here.
Okay.
The U.S. market has averaged about 9.14% per year over the last 20 years. The average American investor has averaged about 3%.
Oh, boy.
Now, the difference, when you are compounding that difference over time, over, say, an investment lifetime, we really could be looking at the difference between having a $200,000 portfolio and a $1 million portfolio. It is that big a difference. And there are two reasons. One, people speculate, and two, people pay fees that are too high. But the one that is most damaging is the speculation.
And those sort of things are hard to imagine when you're first starting out, of course.
Sure, because everybody thinks they're infallible. So,
right.
So these products, like you were talking about, a firm like Betterment or a firm like Asset Builder that rebalance for you, mm-hmm. Vanguard does the same with they've got their target retirement funds, which are like a collection of low-cost indexes that get rebalanced every single year. Those also are wonderful products because they remove the emotion and they're cheap.
All right, so Andrew, I think we have a general understanding, so let's take a step back here for a moment. And I'm an international teacher, it doesn't really matter the age, I guess, at this point, and I'm just started making a little bit of extra money. I'm now suddenly saving half my salary, or if I'm married, maybe I'm saving a full salary. What would be some of the first steps you would recommend to somebody who would be new to the investing world but needs to start making the correct first steps?
First, to figure out how much they need to be putting away. You have to have a plan. It's like when you're teaching, you're going just through the motions. Perhaps you're teaching metaphors one day and topic sentences the next and a bit of Shakespeare, and you're just tossing things in without an actual plan. Mm-hmm. And what we need to do whenever we're setting any kind of goal, whether it's a business-related goal or it's an educational-related goal, we want to know, well, what do we need to see at the end of this? And what a lot of people do is they start investing without any concept of where are they going, how much do they need to be putting away, and why. And so the very first thing to do is to figure out how much money do you actually need. And so with the second book that I wrote, The Global Expatriate's Guide to Investing, I spent
right.
the first two or three chapters going through this process and showing people how they could actually determine and how much they should be saving. And that is very specific for each individual. Some people may choose to retire in Thailand, and so there's a certain type of lifestyle that they want. Others will choose to retire in New York City. And so these calculations are all very individual. So I went to ISB a number of years ago, I believe, and went through this with a group of the teachers at the International School of Bangkok.
Okay.
Went through the process. And what I find always very interesting is inevitably somebody in the crowd gets upset. They say, you're telling me I need to have $2 million to retire? And I say, no, you're telling you that you need $2 million to retire. So the calculations are all very individual. but I go through this process. And I think that's the most important process before you invest a penny is first pay off all high interest debt.
Sure.
Then where are you actually going to go? So on my website, andrewhelland.com, and I think too, if you just Google international teachers, are you saving enough? I've got a screencast that I've put online anyone can follow through with this process.
All right, I'll be sure to link to that in the show notes. So I have a sense then of how much I want to save. I know that I want to live in New York City in a high-priced apartment, let's say, for example, although that's not true. Then where do I go? Like, I mean, we talked earlier, should I just dump it all in Betterment or whatever and just be happy from there? Or do you think most people should learn a little bit more and maybe put in more effort on their side to make the right choices?
Well, much depends on your nationality as an expatriate, because as a Canadian, for example, I could not use Betterment. But there are, for Americans, it's both easier and it's not easier. And so let me explain that. That process really took me a whole book to actually explain. So I'm going to try and summarize that as best I can here.
All right, you got 30 seconds. Ready, go.
Okay, I can do it.
You can go a little longer if you want.
I can do it. There are brokerages that expatriate Americans can use as expats, but no non-American can use those brokerages. So that's number one. So if you're an American and you're investing with such and such a brokerage and your friend's Canadian, your friend should just close their ears because they will not be able to follow what you're doing in terms of the actual brokerage used. It's a totally different animal. Likewise, if you are living in Indonesia and you're a Brit, for example, you're British, you're living in Indonesia, there are some offshore brokerages that you can use to build low-cost portfolios. But there are others that will close the doors to you because you live in Indonesia. So there, of course, are groups that will float through your business. They'll float into your school. They'll want to make it really easy for you. They'll set you up with a platform through a variety of groups that are absolute financial ripoffs. Mm-hmm. Groups like Friends Provident, Generali. Royal Scandia, Alexander Beard, they'll wander through, they'll make this easy for you, and you'll pay horrific fees. So you really got to understand which brokerages you can use to make this happen. So it's hard for me to explain this in 30 seconds because it took me a long, long time to culminate all of this information in my book.
Right. Okay, so that would be a good source. So we can go to your website to start from there or look on Amazon, which I've done in the past.
Yeah, I took the book into sections. So expatriate Canadians, expatriate is a full chapter for them. Expatriate Brits, expatriate New Zealanders, there's a chapter for Australians, a chapter for South Americans, the chapter for South Africans, so the chapter for Europeans. So I took the available options and went through and wrote how people of different nationalities can actually pull this off. And then, of course, giving the certain caveats suggesting that, okay, now if you're living in Japan and you're Canadian, that brokerage and that brokerage and that brokerage will say, no, you can't invest, but this one will. So it's a bit of a, I don't want to say it's a minefield because I've laid out the map quite simply.
Okay.
It used to be a minefield.
All right, so let's look at maybe by age group here a bit. So I've got three different age groups. We can just start with the younger guys. What do you think like a 20-something should be thinking about when it comes to investing? Now, I think back when I was in my 20s, I actually had a very good friend who said, Michael, you need to throw money into mutual funds. They're a little bit newer in those days. And he said, just throw it into Janus for now. And I threw in like $50 a month, and I've been investing in an index fund or a mutual fund of some sort ever since. So it was great. It just created that habit. But what do you think personally a 20-something should think about, and maybe where should they start thinking as far as risk when it goes to investing?
Well, they have to get going right away. An expat takes a massive risk in actually living abroad because they are not contributing to Social Security. If they work their entire careers overseas,
good point.
They may not qualify for Social Security. And if they do qualify, they may just get a pittance. And so that in itself, and sort of each country, Germany and Canada and Australia, they all have their equivalents, as well as many businesses or many teachers mm-hmm. back in these other home countries end up getting defined benefit pension programs as well. So somebody in their 20s, they are going to have a lot of more cash than they typically have in their home country. They're probably paying fewer or lower taxes. In some cases, they are having their rent paid for, and they feel like they're on easy street.
Right.
They're actually on the financial endangered list, and they don't know it.
All because they're not thinking at six what's they're going to be like 45 years from now.
They're not thinking that. They are entirely on their own. And so there's no defined benefit pension for them. There's potentially no Social Security for them. They're really on their own here.
Okay.
So they've got to think about getting their money working as efficiently as possible. And so typically when you're younger, you can take slightly higher risk. So getting back to that question, you would be looking at slightly higher stock market exposure and slightly lower bond market exposure. So, for example, somebody who's 25 years old may have something like 15 to 25% bonds, and so bond index, and the rest into diversified stock indexes. Their domestic country index plus an international index.
Do you believe in the what I've heard, where your age should equal the percentage you'd invest in bonds? So 30 years old would be 30% in bonds, for example.
It's a pretty good rule of thumb. It's if somebody at home, if say in the United States, they've got a defined benefit pension, they mm-hmm. really don't. They really don't need to have a bond component that is equivalent to their age, because they've got the pension, which is essentially like a bond anyway. It's just. It's a virtual guarantee. It's as much of a guarantee as you're going to get. So for them, I would suggest that now if you're 40 years old and you live in Colorado and they've got a nice public, I don't even know if Colorado has a, yes, Colorado does. Colorado has a nice defined benefit pension for teachers.
Yeah, they do.
They would need, you know, they could get away with having a much higher allocation of stocks and bonds. But, you know, that's a good rule of thumb that you brought in, where you talked about the age equaling the allocation of bonds.
Right.
I believe that sort of a 40-year-old should have somewhere between 30 to 40% in bonds. If they can really handle the volatility of the markets and the ups and downs, and they actually kind of like the ups and downs, and it doesn't bother them one bit, well, maybe they could do with 25% bonds. The lower the bond allocation over time, the higher returns are going to be. So you just have to recognize what you can handle. Now, as you get older, you're going to want more stability, because eventually you're going to be at a point where you're going to be needing this money on a regular basis. So
that's when time becomes your enemy, you're saying.
Yes. So you don't want to be taking such massive risks. It's kind of like if you're saving for your child's education and your child is 16 years old, if you have all of that money in the stock market when your child is 16, knowing full well that at 18 you're going to be withdrawing a full quarter of it mm-hmm. and then the rest of it over the ensuing 3 years, if you've got 100% of your child's education money in the stock market and the child is 16, you're insane.
Yes, okay. But, you know, that would probably be pretty typical, because you want to make a lot of money because those fees are expensive.
Exactly. But recognize, too, that the stock market itself, it can easily and routinely drop by 20, 25. We've seen it in our lifetime drop 45%. And there's no reason why next time it doesn't stay there for five or six years. And so if that happens and you've got 100% portfolio for your child's education, it's in 100% in stocks, and all of a sudden it gets cut in half, and the child is 16, and the market stays down for 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
You're in a bit of trouble.
So it's essentially the same thing like retirement, I guess.
Yeah, and retirement, you don't necessarily need to have, know full well that you're not depleting the entire portfolio within a four-year period as you would with a child. Hopefully, if you retire at 60, hopefully you've got another 25 years to go. So you still want some growth. And so for that reason, you know, something like, you may want to say something like 50% stocks, 50% bonds, something like that. I know it gets not quite the bond allocation equaling your age as you get older, but it you do want an element of growth as well.
All right, so when you get into, let's say, your 40s and 50s, you're starting to hit peak earning years. Should you be thinking about saving higher amounts at that point because you're getting a little older, or maybe it depends on how much you have saved so far? What would you suggest?
Well, the more that you can save early on, the better, because that's the money that really rocks.
Okay, right, because you have time, right.
Yeah, but of course, a lot of people don't start until later on. And those people are going to have to really ramp it up. If they figure out that they're behind the eight ball a little bit, they're going to have to figure out ways to start cutting corners with their spending. And one of the things I recommend is to write everything down. So get an app that will track your spending, and you buy a chocolate bar, you put it in. Everything that you buy. So at the beginning of the year, you make a plan. You're going to save X amount. And this comes back to the thing that I talked about at the very beginning, knowing how much you're going to save and exactly why. So set an ambitious goal, perhaps a goal that's maybe even a little bit more than you actually need to invest, and then put that somewhere. Stick that on a piece of paper in the bathroom or in a closet that you open every single day, and then try to reach that goal and figure out how much you need to put away every month to reach it. And then the thing that I find works best is to just track your spending, because one thing that will occur is if you're spending a lot of money on, say, Starbucks, you don't even know you're spending a lot of money on Starbucks until you start looking at the app and the expense tracker, and you say, gosh, look how much I'm actually spending on coffees out. Well, I can cut that back. And when you do that, it's like diet. It's the same thing. When you write down what you're actually eating, people find they start eating fewer donuts because they're ashamed to write it down.
Hey, don't insult donuts. We're talking about finances here.
The same thing.
So that way you get to see it in the aggregate, of course, you know, where your money's actually going.
Yeah, we always did that. We always, I've tracked, my wife and I track every penny we spend.
And you're still friends? You guys must have agreed in the beginning to be that way, or did one of you have to convince the other?
You know, that's the thing about a couple is you have to work as a team. You have to figure out what a joint goal is. And the goal has to be joint. Otherwise, you don't get anywhere. You end up just spinning your wheels. So you have to come to, at some point, it might be a compromise. One person wants X amount at the end or wants to retire with X amount. The other person says, well, no, I'm more satisfied with this in terms of how much they'd be spending on a regular basis. And I think they have to come together as a team and then work together as a team. So it doesn't work if one person is spending all the money and booking the five-star resorts and the other person is actually doing their best to be frugal and documenting everything and the other person isn't documenting or not helping out. That doesn't work. It's a recipe for disaster.
Got it. All right, let's turn, Andrew, a little bit to you. So, you know, you are a teacher. You, at some point, were, I assume you're teaching somewhere in Canada and you're maybe trying to read Hawthorne and tell your kids just how wonderful that, you know, that author is. How did you get interested in this sort of thing? Like, what happened?
I was 19 when I started investing. And okay. I had a job, it was a summer job, working at a bus depot. And I was like a...
I'm sorry. Did you say investment firm? Is that what you said?
No, sorry. Oh. at a bus depot.
Oh, that's what I thought you said, but I just a little unclear. Okay, go ahead.
So I fueled the city buses at the end of the day. That was my job. Fueled them and checked their water, and then drove them through an automated bus wash, and then parked it for the night. So that was my sort of repetitive job. And there was a mechanic there, who was rumor had it he was a millionaire. And it didn't make any sense to me. I couldn't figure out how a guy on a mechanic's salary could be a millionaire. And I knew his salary. It was about $48,000 a year.
Okay.
And this, again, this was 1989. So, a decent salary.
Yeah, but that's Canada. Don't you get paid to just be alive in Canada?
No, who said that? We pay taxes through the yin-yang, man.
oh, that's right. Never mind.
Yeah, so he... rumor had it he was a millionaire, and one day we sat down and he started teaching me things far more than I ever learned in school or in college or from anyone. And he said to me, you can do what you love to do. He says, I love pulling wrenches. I just love it here. This is what I love doing. And he said, you can learn to do what you can do whatever you want to do within reason. I mean, go for that sort of middle class type salary. And get money working for you rather than you having to work really hard for money. And that, probably because there's this little piece of me that's lazy, and I thought, man, I want to be like this guy where I can be in control of what I'm doing at a relatively young age where nobody really has me by the short and curlies. If my boss decides he's going to fire me or if the company decides it's going to go bankrupt or whatever happens, going to be okay. And so that was a goal that I had early on. And that's when I started investing at, and why I started investing at 19.
And then it's just been ever since you're just learning along the way and getting interested and probably just became a bit of a hobby, I would suspect.
Yeah, learning along the way. I read about 400 books on finance.
Oh, really? I was thinking 300 would be enough, but you recommend 400?
No, yeah. I probably read, and I don't recommend that. The good ones all say the same thing.
Okay.
And so that was one thing that I started to find as it shaped my investment philosophy, that virtually all of the academic data on investments and on funds, actually all of it was saying the exact same thing. Invest with low-cost index funds. Do not invest with the actively managed funds that financial advisors will try to sell you. Mm-hmm. And so that is the consistent message that you'll get in any academic paper as it relates to investing, and in any book that compares index funds with actively managed funds.
Okay. All right, I'd like to turn now to a game you may be familiar with called Buy, Sell, or Hold. Well, I ask you a question and you say whether that is something that should be bought, sold, or held. Does that sound like fun?
I haven't heard of the game, but...
Oh, okay. Well, I took it actually, if you're probably familiar with the Motley Fool, and I stole it directly from them. It's something they've done frequently.
Yeah, those guys are a funny bunch, really.
They are. They got. I got interest in them many years ago when I started getting interested in investing. They were a good start for me.
I will tell you one thing, though. Don't get too interested in them. If you've followed them long enough, and what they do is they cherry pick they'll say, okay, David Gardner has earned X amount of money through his stock picks. I've been following the Motley Fool since 1996. Their track record against, say, a U.S. stock market index is appalling.
Uh-oh.
So what they've done is they'll cherry pick little sections of time, but those guys have given advice that in pockets has been good and in areas has been awful. So you might as well just be flipping a coin. So I don't actually recommend their speculative component or this stock is good or that stock is good. I really, really want to get through to readers that ignore that stuff, build a diversified portfolio of index funds, rebalance it, and never speculate.
I think what I learned mostly from them was the buy and hold theory. So I never really did individual stocks much, but that they always said, go long, go long, go long.
No, that's good. That's good. Occasionally, they've got some good stuff too. That's the thing. They've got all kinds of stuff. They've got a whole mix. They've got so many writers.
Yeah, and the radio show is pretty good. All right. Okay, you ready?
Ready.
So okay, it's buy, sell, or hold. Buy, sell, or hold the future of international teaching.
Buy.
You thought I'd pick a stock or something, huh?
I didn't know what you were going to do.
I know this. I've not given you these ahead of time. I got like two more or so. What do you think? Buy, sell, or hold the future of international teaching?
Buy.
Okay. Why is that?
Why? Man, that's like saying why is air good? Man, it just got this wonderful combination of so many kids from so many different places who can influence the world in so many amazing ways. It's like the greatest venue to both be a student and an educator.
Okay. All right. Well, next one. Buy, sell, or hold financial literacy as part of our teaching curriculum.
Buy, buy, buy.
And why would you say that?
I tell my students that I used to teach high school personal finance. Mm-hmm. And I said there are two courses in the school that are the most important courses. And I would ask them to tell me what they were. And kids would say English. And I'd say no. And they would say physics, AP physics. No. Mm-hmm. They'd say biology. I'd say no. The number one, or the number two at least, I would say is this class here, personal finance. And I'd say it was one of the top two because it is the only subject whereby the students are going to be utilizing its components every single day of their lives. So to analyze Shakespeare, no, that's really not something that they're going to be doing typically unless they go into becoming a professor or English or what have you. Mm-hmm. Biology, okay, there's some of this if you're going into the medical field, but finance, personal finance, so understanding credit cards, understanding compound interest, understanding how the financial service industry is not your friend. I said that was the number two or the second most important class in any high school. And if it ain't there, there are some serious problems with that school. I'm just going to be really blunt about that. The number one is health. Health. P and health for the same reason.
All right, last question. Buy, sell, or hold the likelihood that overseas teachers will spend more time picking their investment options than they will choosing which beer they want to buy at the grocery store.
How do you do a buy, sell, or hold on that one?
Well, the likelihood that they'll, you know, what would you do if that was a stock?
Would you buy that notion?
Yeah, or would you sell it? Yeah, the notion, sure.
I'll buy the notion that they'll spend more time figuring out what beer to buy.
Okay. All right. Well, I've been speaking with Andrew Hallam. He's the author of two popular books on investing, The Millionaire Teacher, The 9 Rules of Wealth You Should Have Learned in School, and The Global Expatriate's Guide to Investing from Millionaire Teacher to Millionaire Expat. Thanks so much for your time today, Andrew.
Thanks very much, Mike.
This interview was brought to you by 21st Century Learning International. Find us on the web at 21clradio.com.